Welcome to part 5, Postmodernism. I know you thought we'd never get here, but if it's any consolation, the amount of material we're going to cover in this section is pretty much as big, at least on the printed paper, as all the sections we've covered already. And as I keep saying, I don't think you can understand the concepts, or at least all of the concepts, or at least understand them well, if you haven't really understood what comes before. You'll have half an understanding, and if you want to go into a debate round with half an understanding, do so at your own risk. Okay, postmodernism. What we'll cover in this final section is a mishmash of ideas that can loosely be defined as postmodern. There are enough schools of thought with contrary ideas and opinions in this area to fill shelf upon shelf of unreadable books, which they do, despite the fact that much of postmodern thought is related to linguistics or language. It's surprising how many postmodern writers are incapable of expressing the simplest idea clearly. In fact, some postmodern writers set out to write unclearly as part of their approach to their material. We'll do our best to machete our way through this underbrush, trying to make things, if not academically perfect. I wouldn't want to submit any of this to a college POMO professor. Then at least understandable. We'll look at a handful of key ideas and try to find some good stuff you can take away and study further. Think of this as a starting point for exploration of modern or postmodern thought. As always, we need a reminder that every thinker of the late 20th century is not necessarily postmodern, just like every early 20th century artist was not necessarily a modernist. Quite the contrary. There's plenty of contemporary thought that owes nothing to modernism and postmodernism. The vast body of what you would call practical philosophers are in a different business altogether and hold many of the ideas and concepts at the vanguard of critical theory, which is an offshoot of postmodernism, to be hooey of the first order. Plenty of philosophers believe enough in objective reality to find POMO claims of the lack of same to be pure nonsense, and the classic philosopher, trained in logic and at least the perceived goal of elucidating important ideas clearly, finds little to rejoice in with the gruesome writing of the POMOs, many of whom do not even themselves make claims to be philosophers, or worse, make the claim but provide none of the training or depth of skills. On the other hand, much of modern thought that has been adapted by the POMOs is based on the best and truest science of the times, and is to some extent in tune with modern philosophy. Some of the things we'll discuss here are perfectly orthodox, and in fact do not at all fit under the category of postmodernism. Our point is to find the key modern ideas and explore them. There's no test at the end of the lecture. We'll look at semiotics, structuralism, deconstruction a la Derrida, power a la Foucault, simulation and simulacra a la Baudrillard. We'll look at critical theory and some other random ideas, and once again we'll look at the expressions of those lines of thought in the arts. The last thing I want to say at this point is this. Postmodernism is not a movement. Postmodernism isn't like rationalism, or empiricism, or utilitarianism, or any other specific line of thought. Postmodernism is totally undefined, except by individuals defining it for their own purposes. It's not a clear and simple movement you can point to. It means different things to different people. Which means we'd better begin by trying, however hard this may be, to pin it down a little. Let's go back to our starting point. Let's go back to thinking about narrative. Let me tell you what happened. Here was the problem. Look back at modernism. Look back at all those divergent ideas that in one way or another marked the separation of art from its narrative context. Look back at art becoming not about the narrative, but about the narration. Not about the subject, but about the style. paintings without brushstrokes, with the wrong colors, the wrong perspective, the wrong composition. Let me put it this way. For hundreds of years, if you wanted to understand art, you looked at how good the painting was against very specific and clear rules, if you want to call them that. How can you understand art in a world of modernism where all the rules are being called into question? And especially, how can you understand art in a world of modernism if you happen to be an art critic, or music critic, or literary critic, or even more important, an art academic, a music academic, a literary academic? That's a big question. When artists concentrate on the narration rather than the narrative, or on extreme self-expression, what do critics and academics concentrate on? The answer is simple. The critics concentrate on how the artist narrated rather than what the artist narrated. As a result of modernism, the movement in criticism and academia starts to comment entirely on the narration rather than on the content of the narrative. Eventually, this becomes true of reading both contemporary and pre-contemporary texts. As the critics develop a set of tools to understand pure narration, they start adapting these tools to any narrative they can find. If we read Dickens, we no longer wonder about the living conditions of the poor. We wonder if Dickens was a male chauvinist pig who beat both his wife and his mistress. And we try to find this out through our reading of his books with the new critical tools developed for the purpose. And that is one very real basis of postmodernism. How can critics respond to modernism? In the same way artists tried to find new ideas in the modern, critics tried to find new ideas to explain the modern. And those ideas became known as postmodernism. Additionally, the artists themselves were forced to address the existence of the modern, and those who did so directly created postmodern works contemporaneously with the critics developing postmodernist analysis. So you have critics and academics and artists all responding to modernism, which itself came in a million different flavors. Is there any wonder that there are so many different ideas about what postmodernism is? POMO is most popular in academia, although there is some suggestion, or dare I say hope, that its popularity is diminishing, that some of the ideas we're going to be discussing may in fact be passé. So apply it to the real world at your own risk. But be that as it may, some of the ideas are absolutely fascinating, so fascinating that you want to apply them to everything in the real world. And in one or two cases, that's not a bad idea at all. As we start, we can isolate one very key idea that will define the postmodern for us. In the classical, it was about the narrative. In the modern, it was about the narration. In the postmodern, it's about the narrator. Let me tell you what happened. Me? Let me tell you what happened? But who are you to tell me what happened? You don't own the narrative, even if you're the author of a work of fiction. You do not own the interpretation. Anyone can interpret the text. No interpretation is better than any other interpretation, because language is a slippery construct with no underlying reality, because your truth is no better than my truth in a relative universe. All the words can do, or all the text can do, is make references to other words or texts. In the postmodern, the narrator is removed from the equation. What matters is the reading of the text, the interpretation. And we are all the interpreters. And no interpretation is better than any other interpretation. An assertion that it is your narrative, that you are the author, is an assertion that you hold power over me as your reader, or that the narrative contains truth. This assertion of power is an evil thing, used only to make that false claim of truth. The more you assert power, the more you try to inflict your narration or your interpretation of the narrative on others, the worse you are. If you are the state, then providing a narrative of history or culture, you are in the position to exercise the most power and be the most evil by inflicting your narrative on the people, on the masses. The postmodernist reading of this lecture is that I am inflicting my reading of the text of history on my students, and that this is a straightforward abuse of power. The students should make their own individual readings of the text. A postmodern analysis can point out my abuses of women, minorities, age groups, the French, the philosophes, Plato, you name it. The minute I begin, let me tell you what happened, I have committed a political action. At that minute, you respond by telling me your own interpretation of what happened, knowing that both our interpretations will of necessity be wrong, since they are simply individual interpretations. And, surprisingly enough, there is some reasonable basis for all of this nonsensical hooey that I've just been spewing at you. Let me tell you what happened. Shut up and listen. Let's start with semiotics, because there's some remarkable truth in semiotics. And to begin, let's look at an example. Okay, I'm surfing the TV remote. I click to a dog show and see in the first instant a dog I've never seen before. First of all, I know immediately it is a dog. This is because I recognize the signs of its dogness. Shape, the way it's being handled, the way it walks, hairiness, size. My brain reacts to the sight of what's on the TV and immediately concludes, a dog. This is true even of little children, who would also look at the new dog they've never seen before and also instantly recognize it as a dog, even though, as I say, they have never seen that particular breed of dog before. It's not hard to recognize those signs of dogness, even for a preschooler. But each of us brings more to it than that, more than the mere knowledge that the object before us is a dog. When we look at a dog, our brains perform a series of calculations, collating all our previous dog experiences. Our brains fire on our personal history with dogs, as much as we know of the natural history of jackals and coyotes, our memories of the Beethoven and Benji movies, Odie from Garfield, the history of the Westminster Dog Show, a million different elements, everything that is connected in our minds to the idea of dog. Remember one of our original assertions that humans have an instinct to narrative. We are hardwired to make stories out of things, to connect things. Charles Peirce, P-E-I-R-C-E. Charles Peirce was a philosopher whose work on the concept of signs provides a basis for the study known as semiotics. And semiotics is essentially an attempt to understand how humans make those narrative connections that we've been maintaining are instinctual. Peirce was an American who may be the easiest to read on this subject. He doesn't write with a lot of obfuscating language. According to Peirce, we think only in signs. Signs. Signs take the form of words, images, sounds, odors, flavors, acts, or objects. But such things have no intrinsic meaning and become signs only when we invest them with meaning. Nothing is a sign unless it's interpreted as a sign. Anything can be a sign as long as someone interprets it as signifying something, that is, referring to or standing for something other than itself. We interpret things as signs, largely unconsciously, by relating them to familiar systems of conventions. It's this meaningful use of signs which is at the heart of semiotics. In other words, you're walking down the street, you see a sign that has nothing on it but, oh, let's say a man walking a dog. you get the idea that, okay, this must be the place to go walk your dog, or maybe the guy's cleaning up after the dog, so you get the idea, well, here's where we go. We have to clean up, because that's the law. But the sign is separate from a real man with a real dog. But we get the message. Signs send us the message of the meaning. The other seminal semiotician, there's a phrase for you, the other seminal semiotician is the French linguist Ferdinand de Saussure. Saussure defined a sign as being composed of a signifier, the form which the sign takes, and the signified, the concept it represents. The relationship between the signifier and the signified is referred to as signification, and the sign is the whole that results from the association of the signified with the signifier. And this is where the material starts getting difficult. Not so much in the concepts, but in the way the concepts are explained. What is being said here is that you see or hear or smell something, and that connects to a pre-existing idea or set of ideas you already have. One thing signifies something else. The first thing, the one that signifies, is neutral, devoid of meaning. What it signifies is what gives it the meaning. The use of variants in the word sign, this is true either in English or French, make for our confusion, and these guys aren't even trying to be confusing. As a linguistic example of a sign, the word open, when it is invested with meaning by someone who encounters it on a shop doorway, is a sign consisting of a signifier, the word open, and a signified concept, that the shop is open for business. The same signifier, the word open, could stand for a different signified and thus be a different sign if it were on a push button inside an elevator. It would mean push to open door. Similarly, many signifiers could stand for the concept open. For instance, on top of a packing carton, a small outline of a box with an open flap for open this end, with each unique pairing constituting a different sign. Contemporary semioticians study signs not in isolation, but as part of semiotic sign systems, such as a medium or genre. They study how meanings are made, as such being concerned not only with communication, but also with the construction and maintenance of reality. Semiotics is often employed in the analysis of texts, although it is far more than just a mode of textual analysis. In the way we have been defining text, that is, any narrative, a text is an assemblage of signs, such as words, images, sounds, and/or gestures, constructed and interpreted with reference to the conventions associated with a genre and in a particular medium of communication. The thing to know is that semiotics is the study of signs and symbols. One neutral thing, the signifier, refers to other meaningful things, the signified. Our brains collect indicators or references, whatever. Our brain connects those unconnected dots of perceived reality. When we encounter a signifier, we are provided with a way of connecting some of those dots. The semiotician would put it another way. Our understanding of reality is our reading of the signs. In the semiotic model, we can analyze a thought or an object by evaluating what it signifies. The mind works by connecting signifiers. And a corollary of this is that I can see how someone else's mind works by reading their signs. So what's the point of all of this? It has to be more than just seeing an open sign on a door and figuring out that the shop is open. And it is. First, it sets up a system for understanding how the mind works. The mind, according to this line of philosophical reasoning, works by identifying signs. Second, it allows us to evaluate the workings of a given mind. We can see how someone connects the signs, or connects the dots, and read that text of their connections. We can do this because we theoretically understand how the narration, in this case, thinking, works. And third, I can take signs and study them as signs. Why is such and such a sign, and what does it mean signify? This leads to a lot of interesting areas of study in and of themselves, because some signs are invested with so much signification. Coke, for instance, is not merely a sign of a beverage. It's the original signifier of American commercial globalization. Disney is a favorite subject of a lot of modern thinkers, and Disney certainly has incredible semiotic fascination. Not only is Disney a company represented by a mouse, globalization, Disneyfication as in applying the Disney theme park planning model to the real world, commercialization of art, but it has a long history of creating versions of archetypal narratives that rework the original meanings. Compare Disney's Snow White to the Grimm's Snow White, for example. Sign, sign everywhere a sign. Uncle Ben, the Cleveland Indians, Reader's Digest, McDonald's. And the interesting thing is, to a degree, the semioticians are correct when they talk about connecting the little signifying dots. This is exactly how the mind works, according to the latest understandings. Thinking is a process very much as the semioticians describe it. Our minds are loose connections of data, the dots. Thinking is the action of agents connecting those data dots. The resulting thought is the connection of signifieds. In other words, the mind is a narrative processing machine, a narrative creating machine, which I've been saying all along. Let me amplify what I just said. We're starting to see real scientific work proving philosophical constructs. There's even a word for this, consilience, coined by E.O. Wilson. This refers to a coming together of the hard and soft sciences. At some point, the way the brain works physiologically should connect to philosophy and psychology if any of those disciplines are going to make a pretense of being truth. And it's happening. It's not just highfalutin theory anymore, as in Freud, for instance, who made his stuff up with no basis in science. Today, we control thoughts with drugs. And we believe that emotions evolve. And we've thrown out the model of the blank slate. And the mind works roughly the way the semioticians say it works. There's another word for all this sign, signified, signification business, by the way. That word is metaphor. We don't know anything for real. All we know is metaphors for reality. Signs, thoughts, call it what you will. The word metaphor will pop up repeatedly in postmodern analysis. This is not easy material. What we just said was that we don't register reality in our brains. We register metaphors. We register concepts. Reality, whatever that is, if in fact there is such a thing, is merely the trigger for the connection of signs to be jiggled around in our brains and to send some kind of message to central processing and say, bzz, bzz, over here, bzz, bzz, over there, bzz, bzz, put them all together. Hey, it's a dog. You may find it hard to understand what I'm saying in the lecture, and you may be better off reading it. Some people may find it easier to hear it than to actually read it. That's why I've done the lecture in the PDF. If you're not getting it in one, try the other. And of course, look at some of the backup materials that I'm talking about. Some of the, you know, primary sources. Read Peirce. Read Saussure. Read these people. At least give them a shot. Read other explanations of these people, and I've given various reading suggestions over the years on the website to understand postmodernism or modern thought. Don't try to get it all at once. It takes a long time to understand this material. Anyhow, the next thing we're going to talk about is structuralism. This is a big idea, a big 20th century idea, structuralism. You hear the word structuralism, and for that matter, you hear the word post-structuralism, in a lot of modern thought, and it's very much, or at least structuralism, is very much what we've been talking about in this essay, or in this lecture. We've been contemplating the idea of no longer studying the content of a narrative, whatever it is, but studying the nature of narration, of the narration. Now here's a definition I picked up somewhere. In structuralism, the individuality of the text disappears in favor of looking at patterns, systems, and structures. Some structuralists propose that all narratives can be charted as variations on certain basic universal narrative patterns. In other words, structuralism is the study of process rather than of content, the study of narration rather than of narrative. Very convenient. In a nutshell, the nice thing about structuralism is that the word really means exactly what you think it means, the search for and studying of underlying structure. Claude Levi-Strauss is the daddy of all structuralism. An anthropologist who studied cultures, Levi-Strauss claimed that radically different cultures were structurally identical, that in fact there was such a thing as a structure of culture, and all individual cultures were merely individual expressions of that one structure. In our terms, the narratives of the French and the Ooga Boogas may be different, but their cultures boil down to the same elements comprising the same structures. From the scientific point of view, the structuralist says, find the comparable elements that comprise the structures, and you'll understand what makes a culture, what a culture boils down to, what all cultures have in common, even though they look different. From that point, you study not the French or the Ooga Boogas, you study the structure itself. And then, ultimately, you will understand culture qua culture, what makes a culture in the first place. From that point, you can understand a specific culture because you understand how that specific culture relates individually to the general structure or concept of culture overall. The structuralist, therefore, looks for the underlying patterns, for commonalities. You can apply structuralism to virtually anything, and that open application underlies some of the most important thinking of the modern age. Structuralism in literature, structuralism in psychology, structuralism in philosophy, you name the discipline, there's a structuralist approach to it. A simplistic structuralist approach to debate would study not the narratives of debate, the cases, but the underlying structure, same as anything else. That is, the structuralist would study the forms of the opposing sides. What is an aff or an egg always trying to do, rather than their arguments themselves on a given topic? What is this aff or this neg trying to do? No question about it, this is narration versus narrative, or the structuralist can look at the topic and evaluate the structures relevant to the subject rather than the narrative, the individual arguments in a given round of each side. What we would commonly call a critique is, in fact, a structuralist analysis of debate or of a resolution. Anyhow, structuralism is one of the biggest intellectual deals of the modern age. The end result of structuralism is the realization of similarities in disparate situations. The French aren't all that different from the Ooga Boogas. And the recognition of narration as a unique object of study separate from the study of narrative. Okay, the next big idea we're going to look at is deconstruction. The most misunderstood, misused word in contemporary dialogue. Deconstruction is primarily associated with the French thinker Jacques Derrida. Note that I do not call him a philosopher. Those who subscribe to his theories do call him a philosopher. I'm agnostic about the depth of Jacques Derrida. There may or may not be a philosophical construct underlying deconstruction as it relates to Derrida. For that matter, there may or not be truth underlying deconstruction as it relates to Derrida. I do not know. The reason I don't know is that Jacques Derrida is the epitome of the unreadable writer. Is he dense because he's deep or because he's confused? Is his narration confused because he believes that narration cannot be anything but confused? Or is he just a confusing writer? Depends on your point of view. You love him or you hate him, or you love or hate his writing, depending on that starting point. Everything that I understand about him, I've gotten through secondary resources. If you can read him yourself and make sense of him, be my guest. He's all yours. Anyhow, the principle of deconstruction goes like this, and this is quoted now from a true believer. The guiding insight of deconstruction is that every structure, be it literary, psychological, social, economic, political, or religious, that organizes our experience is constituted and maintained through acts of exclusion. In the process of creating something, something else inevitably gets left out. These exclusive structures can become repressive, and that repression comes with consequences. Derrida insists that what is repressed does not disappear, but always returns to unsettle every construction, no matter how secure it seems. Monsieur Derrida understood all too well the danger of beliefs and ideologies that divide the world into diametrical opposites, right or left, red or blue, good or evil, for us or against us. He showed how these repressive structures, which grew directly out of the Western intellectual and cultural tradition, threatened to return with devastating consequences. Now that's a pretty clear explanation. Societal structures have inherent exclusions. Structure here is not meant in the structuralism sense of the word, necessarily simply in the idea of the things that make up society. For instance, women are excluded from modern government structures based on Locke because women were excluded from 18th century politics. That exclusion can lead to or be repression. For example, women not voting. And that repression can have bad effects today, as in even though women are theoretically equal to men, in fact they are still second-class citizens socially, economically, politically, whatever. The issue is, it may be hard to see how women are second-class citizens, since legally that's not supposed to be true. The deconstructionist can point out how. So if you take this a few steps further, it's not what you say that matters, but what you don't say. It's not the text narrative that's the problem. It's what underlies the text narrative. The process of exclusion is structural or inherent. What you don't say represses, excludes something important, and that exclusion leads to problems. So is this philosophy, sociology, politics, Frenchiness? Take your pick. One thing, though, is extremely popular in some academic circles, especially in the subject of literature. A literary example of deconstruction could be, say, Dickens. We analyze what Dickens doesn't say about women to understand the anti-feminist subtext of Victorian England. Not that Dickens' works aren't filled with women, except that his women are usually his least interesting or memorable or, for that matter, well-drawn characters. But their blandness or forgettability is indicative of a subtext of exclusion of women, or perhaps exploitation of women, or hatred of women. What do Copperfield's two wives tell us about women in the 19th century? We find out by deconstructing the text, evaluating the child bride versus the practical adult woman, and since neither of these is a real individual, we attempt to extrapolate the situation of real individuals from these fictional constructs. Deconstruction is often done for political ends, to understand or expose the repression of groups, and therein is the problem for deciding if deconstruction is right? Should every text be reread against what it doesn't say? Is there a hidden subtext to everything? Is this a good way to go about changing the world? Let's say that we set out to prove that there is anti-feminism in Dickens. So what? It doesn't solve anything. It's not so bad when you're talking about Dickens and literary criticism, but if you approach politics as a deconstructionist, the question is, then what? You go about pointing out that some group or other is excluded, but the deconstructionist offers no solution. And what if you deconstruct debate resolutions? Point out all the exclusions, the inherent flaws. Well, you're a Frenchman sitting in a cafe with a filter, a gauze, and a chip on your shoulder. You're not changing the world. You're merely complaining that the world sucks and showing us how it sucks. Comme ça. Thanks a lot. The lack of an ethical construct to solve for the problems delineated by the deconstructionists, or maybe the critiquers, is why so many people find them jejune. As far as literature is concerned, critics of deconstruction and its cousins like critical theory, about which more later, claim that this approach to literature has made much academia into a joke. Newspapers reprint the list of topics at the annual Modern Language Association meetings to hold them up to ridicule, especially when the academics are venturing into popular culture. It's one thing to search for anti-black exclusionism in 19th century jurisprudence, for instance, and another thing altogether to look for it in Bugs Bunny. But people do, and then they write like Derrida in sentences no one can read. Academia becomes a joke, which is another kick against this approach in debate. Most high school teachers are concerned with narratives as narratives. What writers said, not what they didn't say. It's hard enough to teach literature to 15-year-olds without having to battle rabbits that are both wascally and racist. Teachers can be touchy about students dabbling in an arena in which the teachers are made out to be idiots. Can't say as I blame them. In the real world, deconstruction has come to mean an awful lot of things other than what is meant in the Derrida sense. But when used in the Derrida sense, it can be a core of political activism. Deconstruct the State of the Union speech, for example. In the Derrida sense, you'd evaluate how it points up the exclusions of modern America and refer to what wasn't referred to and make a call to arms out of it. A call to arms to do what, however, is what deconstruction does not offer. And the other big Derridean thing we'll come back to is the oppositions, the clash of opposites. The excluded group being somehow the opposite of the included group. As I say, more on that later. Anyhow, so far we've seen signs versus signifier. We see signs of a dog to get the idea of dog. Narrative versus narration. We study structures to understand content narratives. And now you need to remember text and subtext. In deconstruction, you study the subtext to find out what the text is hiding. Which brings us to an interesting point. The word text is big in Pomo land, and there's three major pieces of it. The text is the narrative, the thing at hand. The subtext is what's behind or under the narrative, existing in relation to the stuff the narrative doesn't say. And finally, the context is where this text, this narrative, exists in relation to other texts or narratives. Contexts are much clearer to see than subtexts. The context of, say, Joyce's Ulysses includes father-son narratives, going back to the Greeks, the Odyssey, Irish literature, Irish life, stream of consciousness, experimentation, etc., all real ideas that you can get your mind around. In the olden days, you might say, academics relied heavily on context to understand texts. Today, they rely on subtexts. Text, context, subtext. Pomos love nothing more than throwing around words that you used to think meant one thing and now mean something else altogether. Sorry, get used to it. Let's turn to Foucault. The appeal of Foucault, Michel Foucault, to debate, not only to LD but to policy, is that he talks about power. And certainly the nature of power, who possesses it and who doesn't, is an issue in both areas of forensics. What Foucault says has a strong ring of truth to it. He is not your everyday French crackpot. What Foucault says is also very simple and very obvious when you think about it. And it ties in directly to things like deconstruction. If deconstruction is the search for subtexts indicating who is excluded from the texts, it isn't a long leap to decide that those excluded folks are, one way or another, the powerless. To begin with, there is a very simple underlying starting thesis to Foucault's work, to wit, knowledge is power. Sure, it's a cliché, but in Foucault's hands, it's quite meaningful, especially when you remember that his first work in this area was in the field of mental illness. And let's look at the specifics. According to Foucault, there are a handful of people who have special knowledge about something. This special knowledge confers power on them, and this power derived from knowledge allows them to define what is normal and what is not. As I said, the first big area for Foucault was mental illness, madness. Later he wrote about sex. According to Foucault, it is the doctors, with the power stemming from their knowledge, who decide who is mad and who is normal. The people in asylums are not there because there is some objective measure of sanity and madness. The people in asylums are there because someone in power said these people do not conform to a norm established by the knowledge of the powerful. Since there is no objective normal, the normative is merely a construct, and it's the powerful who determine the construct. It's the powerful who decide who is mad and who isn't. It's the powerful who decide what is normal and what isn't. It's an easy step to see how this can also be applied to sex. Foucault was gay and lived most of his life during a period when being gay was generally considered a perversion. The powerful decided that being gay was not the norm, in other words. And here's where you start forgetting about the knowledge side of the equation. Normal is what the powerful decide is normal. You can see where this leads. The powerful determine right and wrong in a subjective universe because the powerful have the power to enforce punishments for doing wrong and rewards for doing right. That bit about punishment and rewards is pure Foucault. Might makes right in the purest moral sense. And you don't necessarily need knowledge to be mighty. According to this analysis, the normative is what the powerful say it is, not the mean of what everyone does on some sort of objective continuum, which is how you would usually understand the concept of normative normal. There's no objective right or wrong. There's only conforming to the norm as laid down by the powerful, who may or may not have achieved their power through knowledge. Running Foucault, therefore, applies a comparable equation to a debate topic. The next person I want to talk about is Baudrillard. And for those of you who want to know more, there is an essay on the website, mygemenic.com/podcast website, where you can get a full lecture on the book Simulacra and Simulation. Anyhow, finally, because he does connect back to a lot of what we've been talking about, which is the arts, there is Jean Baudrillard. Yeah, he is another Frenchman, and needless to say, the best place to start with Baudrillard is that book Simulacra and Simulation, which actually you can read and understand as much as you're ever going to understand any of this stuff. By the way, this book, Simulacra and Simulation, is the book in which Neo hides his computer disk in the original Matrix film. Baudrillard talks specifically about art in the postmodern world. A simulation is a representation of reality. For example, the France attraction in Epcot is a simulation. Baudrillard loves talking about Disney, by the way. The exhibit, with its versions of real French icons like the Eiffel Tower, is an attempt to recreate France, or maybe more to the point, the essence of an idealized France. The Paris Hotel in Las Vegas does the same thing in much the same way. As a whole, Vegas is nothing more than another version of Disney, according to this line of thinking. But according to Baudrillard, art and reality are moving closer together in the modern world. And when the border between art and reality disappears, you get a simulacrum. This is a quote. The distinction between the signs and what they refer to breaks down. For example, Main Street in the Magic Kingdom is a simulacrum, defined as the recreation of something that never existed. The recreation of something that never existed? In this case, it's the recreation of the idealized image of a small town. And this particular small town never actually existed. We just like to think that it did. And the next step from here is Baudrillard's point, that the simulations and simulacra of influential places like Disneyland have run over into everyday life to the point that we are living in houses and towns that are not real anymore. We are simulating real life, and probably we don't even know what real life is anymore. These are the ideas that Baudrillard kicks around, theming the meaning of McDonald's, the meaning of America, in very large quotes. To me, the essence of cultural studies starts with Jean Baudrillard, so if you're interested in the meaning of these particular things, he is a pretty good place to start. He's also nutty as a fruitcake. But that's beside the point.